Welcome back to Radio Rothbard. I'm Ryan McMakin. I'm a senior editor with the Mises Institute. And here with me today is Tho Bishop, our associate editor. And it's been a couple of weeks since we did Radio Rothbard, but it seems now about time to give a report card to Biden or talk about, now that we're living in Biden's world, what do things look like? And have things really changed significantly, or is it just what really has mostly been happening since about the year 2001, which is really, it's the Bush-Obama world we're living in, and with maybe a few deviations here and there. But it seems that we're back to business as usual. At least I think that's what the design was supposed to be of the Biden administration. And let's look and see. And we'll focus this time on domestic policy. I think on a future episode, we'll look a bit at foreign policy, and we don't want to ignore these issues with Russia, and I think there are some real differences there. But for today, we'll look at taxes and social policy and some of those issues. And I think really to kick things off, we should just look at the issues of the economy and what they've got planned for it. And here, I don't think we see big differences. You can note that we had just another $1.9 trillion bailout, stimulus package, whatever you want to call it. But there's nothing new there. That's pretty much more of the same. We had already $4 trillion in stimulus that came out under the Trump administration. That's a big deal when you consider the fact that during Obama, the entire budget amounted from about 3.5 to 4 trillion. And this is on top of it. This is just a special package on top of the entire thing. So we're looking at least a 50% increase minimum, and it's probably going to end up being much, much more than that over a regular budget. So this is huge. And this seems to be that it's necessary because unemployment is still pretty lousy. And we're looking out there and we can see that things are not roaring back. Now, we were told a year ago, there's going to be this V-shaped recovery, and you just need a couple of weeks to slow the spread, and then everything's going to bounce back. And then, of course, 2 weeks to slow the spread's turned into a year to slow the spread. And the economy is not roaring back. They're telling us, oh, GDP growth maybe be 10% in the next quarter, and it's just going to be amazing. But that's 10% over a level of where things had crashed. And you're still digging out of a hole. So yeah, we made some progress in digging out of that hole. But look at the employment numbers. Looking at the most recent numbers here, what do we got? Still looking at total employment being down 9 million from its peak before. We're being told unemployment it's improved so much to only 6.2%. But when you even talk to Fed officials, they're saying, well, really, if you move beyond just the headline number, it's looking at more like 10%. And then we've still got 5 million people that are on just regular unemployment. Those are continuing unemployment claims. You got about 7 to 8 million that are on the special pandemic unemployment program. So there's millions of people out there that are unemployed. The unemployed rate is highly elevated. And so, of course, we're just going to be looking at a lot more spending as an attempt to get us out of that somehow, because they've got no other tools in their toolbox. We'll just spend a lot. We'll just hand out checks to people. And then the Fed, of course, is expected to keep all that going by buying up U.S. debt, by keeping interest rates low. And there's just no real big difference there between this administration and the last one. Now, there's a new Treasury Secretary. We got Janet Yellen. We got some new personnel in there. Tho, what do you see? Is there any real differences in terms of personnel, or are they just going to continue what we've already seen?
Well, of course, one of the interesting things is when you look at the American economy, you know, as it exists today, I mean, it is less united than it's ever been, right? I mean, Florida, for example, that's one area where you do see good times of here again. The unemployment there is, I think, just higher than 5%. It's been growing up rapidly. South Dakota, I think South Dakota is now, like, their unemployment rate is lower than it was prior to COVID. Things are improving in Texas and some of these other states that are opening. And so, you know, that the fallout from those state-based decisions are going to continue to go forward. And, you know, it's interesting. I mean, you may see blue states kind of have that same sort of treatment that the Rust Belt had when, you know, manufacturing started, you know, leaving the U.S. and things like that. You know, unemployment deserts based off of statewide policy and COVID. But the difference, I think, right now, I mean, one of the consequences, I think, long lasting from this past year is that, you know, essentially the foundations of MMT have been accepted on both the left and the right. And I think you actually see it play out perhaps most strongly in some of like the populist right commentary out there, where like they're trying to embrace, hey, we need cultural conservatism mixed with economic left policy, because they're effectively accepting the left's belief that there is no limits to spending outside of political will, right? You know, their priorities are different, but they've essentially baked in that Cheney esque analysis of deficits don't matter anymore, right? And so like I do think there's going to be differences. You know, spending's been out of control for a while. I think some of those priorities are going to matter. For one, I think that you're going to see Republicans were kind of, I think, touching on at the end of 2020 the consequences of the unemployment benefits as part of that COVID stuff, where you had a lot of workers that could work but were refusing to work because there was so much emphasis placed on those programs. I think that's something the Democrats are doubling down on. And so I think that's going to have detrimental impacts on terms of long-term unemployment numbers, you know, how that's going to change job-seeking behavior. And I think that might have changed a little bit if you still had, let's say, a Trump administration, particularly with a Republican Senate. And of course, you know, one of the biggest aspects of this past COVID relief bill was massive bailouts to blue states in particular, that had greater, had pre-existing problems before COVID, but are now being able to use COVID to utilize some of this federal funding to make up for some insane pension schemes and things like that. So again, I think there are some differences, even though spending as a whole has been a bipartisan issue, as no one has done a better job than I think you and your articles on The Wire have documented.
Yeah, the state level bailout thing, I think, is a big deal that allows some of these states that have had some of the worst lockdowns and punished their workers the most will be able to get some free money from the Fed. Because, of course, the states don't have their own central bank. They can't print money. But if they can launder money, essentially, from the federal government, then they can maybe patch some of those holes, some of that destruction they caused with their more stringent lockdowns.
And one of the things that, again, I think this goes to, again, some of the obvious glaring weaknesses of the Trump administration was that, I mean, there's really no difference between Jay Powell being the Fed chairman effectively right now and Janet Yellen during the Obama years, right? I mean, Biden is not restrained because there was a Republican appointed Fed chair. You know, we hit that as soon as Powell was nominated in the first place, right? You know, hey, this is another status quo swamp creature that's going to be in this position, even though there was a while there where he kind of looked like he might have been helping to wind down the balance sheet kind of slowly. I know Danielle DiMartino Booth was optimistic for a time. I think she will admit that she was wrong in that. And I think what's going to be really interesting going forward is that obviously the natural consequence of all this spending and the growth of the money supply that the Fed is now changing the way they report, right? The side of the crypto sphere, I think, is going to be very interesting. One is that, you know, Mnuchin, I think Yellen's going to continue. Or Yellen could continue Mnuchin, who is very anti-crypto, some of those policies that the Mnuchin regime proposed. But the SEC aspect, the way that they might end up governing some of the non-Bitcoin, like the Ethereum and some of the things that, you know, they're considered securities and things like that, that's going to be one of those really interesting fronts. And I will say there's a lot of optimism within the crypto news sources out there there's been a lot of better than perhaps expected hirings in the SEC and some of this sort of stuff in some ways. At the same time, I think the CFTC, there's been some nominees have also been kind of blasted for some of this stuff. So I think you're definitely going to see some very industry shaping regulations come in the next 4 years with the SEC staff that's coming about. Again, how that ends up, you know, working into, you know, potential global adaptations to this clown age of finance. All of that will be very interesting to watch going forward.
Well, it's interesting in our discussion how little of whatever we're talking about has to do with actual legislation passed through Congress, right? There once was a time where in order to change any significant direction in policy required Congress to do something about it. But it's now been so moved over to the executive branch in that when we're talking about SEC regulations and other departments, for example, Bill Anderson wrote an article recently on expect some lawsuits against corporate America for punishing those corporations that have refused to come to heel and run afoul of the trade of the Federal Trade Commission. And at that level, you're going to have real changes. But in terms of real changes in tax level and so on, that's going to have to go through Congress. And I suppose you might see that, but they're going to have to accomplish that before 2022's election, when the Republicans will almost certainly gain the House and maybe make some gains in the Senate. It's hard to say at this point, but that will then just stop that whole thing. So now you're just back to a bunch of executive branch, reward my friends, do some lawsuits here and there, some little issues. And then really it's the Fed just steps in and does all the major changes and sets the groundwork for fiscal policy and monetary policy increasingly.
Of course, you know, the COVID bill was legislation. I think taxing they can do without getting rid of the filibuster. So, I mean, that's going to be the biggest, you know, one of the more interesting narratives out there, you know, going into the midterms is, you know, I mean, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema are the two most powerful people in Washington. And will they be able to apply enough pressure to get them to change their position on the filibuster? Because if that happens, then you have a really it's going to be interesting because, one, it's going to open up a lot more of the floodgates for a lot of a lot more policy than we're used to. Another interesting thing, I know there's been changes to the earmarks at the congressional level, which again doesn't matter if you have that, you know, won't matter that much if you have that 60 vote, you know, matter in the Senate that slows down legislation. But if we do get into a period where we have a lot of legislation passed, those earmarks are, which they got rid of in 2010, sorry, about the Tea Party Revolution. I think that actually helped contribute to a lot of legislation not getting passed because it binded some of the ways that leadership was able to bribe some people. I guess it's kind of a way of oiling the skid there and oiling those gears in a way that, again, bringing that back is going to be interesting. I think the Biden administration started off with issuing more executive orders than ever before. The consequences of them are ever larger than ever before. And so it's going to be interesting that particularly if the Senate, if it loses that traditional filibuster aspect, how do, in particular, Republican states respond? Because that is now the leadership of the Republican Party are all state actors more than performance artists in the Senate. And that's something that I think is potentially a very positive trend for really creating meaningful checks against federal power rather than Fox News headlines.
Well, we haven't mentioned COVID regulation, yeah. Right? And it's significant that we haven't, right? That they haven't even really tried to make any significant changes there because, sure, since it seems anything goes in Washington, why not just come in and say, well, there's a nationwide business closure now. All businesses in America are on 50% seating at restaurants or so on. The sorts of things that governors have done with a stroke of the pen. And there's not even been any talk about the president doing anything like that and making a uniform COVID policy.
Well, because I think it's funny how it happens. I mean, I think it was January 21st, where even blue states were starting to lax their COVID policies. And so I think there is the Democrats realize that a lot of a lot of those heavy-handed things that were detrimental to the Trump's attempts in 2020. We don't want those anymore. And so the politicalization of political health, I think, has never been more explicit in the public discourse. And again, this is a good thing. The more people recognize how much of a fraud this entire thing is, the more people that reject and want to burn their two masks, the better off we're all going to be.
And the fact that it's now just become accepted that it's the state level that determines all these sorts of things, right? And now it doesn't even seem any weird to people that you cross state lines and now you're under a totally different legal regime. Just a year ago, you suggest something like that it might make sense that rather than having a nationwide policy at the state level, they might be able to do the quarantine or whatever, that's the proper level for that. And that struck many people as bizarre, but now that just seems like normal to people. So you're going back on some of your earlier comments, I think in terms of the economy, and also I think in terms of people congregating, people going about their lives, there's going to be like two different countries, I think, this spring. Now, as more and more people can get vaccinated and tell themselves that everything's going to be fine, I think even in the blue states, then you'll start to see people behaving what was normal 18 months ago. But yeah, if you walk around in Georgia or Florida, and then you fly out to California and walk around there, it's going to feel like you're in two different countries.
And I think that's one of the aspects of COVID that it's so obvious that you don't even think about it. I mean, that's what makes this so much different than, like, say, 9/11 or Pearl Harbor or other national tragedies where, again, I was living in Florida, right? Far from New York, but you're filled with the news coverage. And of course, then you're followed up with everyone was concerned about a terrorist attack happening anytime, an anthrax. And so there was a collective response to 9/11 because we as a nation truly felt that, right? COVID, it is a polarizing national event, right? In a way that I can't even think of something similar. I mean, maybe the 2020 election. But like, and the long-term consequence for that, for national unity is, you know, I for all those that think that, oh, well, this was some great master plan for the elite to impose their power. Even if that was true, I think that it's going to backfire tremendously because I think Americans have never been more divided in the ways that matter in terms of legitimacy of the state than they have been right now.
Yeah, if it was part of a master plan, it's not going according to plan, I don't think. Now, they could still win, of course, but there's definitely been, not since the 19th century, such a divisive event that has really divided the U.S. into regions that I think see themselves differently. And of course, people point out, oh, well, and there's always pockets in all the states that are blue or red or whatever. But that's always been true. That was true in the 19th century as well. But yeah, there seems to be a self-filing way. And I'm even reading about people who are moving across state lines because that state seems safer for COVID. I'm afraid of COVID, so I moved to Colorado because it seems safer. Or I hate these restrictions, so I'm moving to Florida to get away from that. And that would have been unheard of 50 years ago for people to move across state lines because they just prefer that regime. Yeah, big companies would do that for tax reasons and stuff like that, but normal people almost never did that.
I was like, of course, all the mask resistors in maybe a state like California, those are like the modern day copperheads, right? You know, small pockets of resistance. And
and of course, they face often the censorship in many cases as well. Although I don't think they meet the same level of being reviled that they were in the 90s, because even in these northern even in some of these places that were pretty pro-secession, I think not much time went by before these copperheads were viewed as traitors, essentially. And they were Clement Vlandigan, I believe was his name, who ended up in exile in Canada or something like that. You can still get away with just completely questioning the regime, and nobody's exiling you anywhere. So things are actually, yeah, really are better than
as
under
long as
Lincoln.
You're not on Twitter.
Yes. Well, that's the thing. Twitter is such a Twitter's not reality, right? And I think people would feel better if they spent a little less time on there. But speaking of that sort of thing, let's move on to our social policy component of this. And, you know, things are weird now in terms of social policy, right? The sorts of things that the right is now supposed to get worked up about. And that is one place where the Biden administration can really push the issue in terms of executive orders about transgender people and women's sports and all of that stuff. And to me, compared to printing up $1 trillion, that strikes me as relatively minor because I'm more concerned about my family being able to keep its head above water financially than about some issue related to Dr. Seuss, right? We were supposed to get so upset about Dr. Seuss, like he was being canceled or something. Meanwhile, Biden's trying to start a war with Russia, and they're passing $2 trillion bailout bills and everything. Oh, no, but be really concerned about Dr. Seuss and make sure and go buy these books that you never even heard of before. These books that they got rid of, I'd never seen in my life. And the guy was a commie, right? Have you ever read The Lorax? Not exactly a bastion of free market thinking and so on. And I'm like, why do I care about this? But it's a great distraction. And other aspects of it, too, is that now conservatives, I'm getting people sending me submissions detailing all the research showing how very important it is for your children to be in public school now, that all children should be in public school, and the fact that teachers' unions aren't opening public schools is horribly detrimental for your children. I do think this shows hypocrisy on the part of those people, but why should we argue that it's important for your kids to be in public school now? That seems like a weird right-wing position to take here. You definitely got to get them back in school so they can be indoctrinated as soon as possible. And then the other issue, right? Suddenly, pro-women's sports is like this cause célèbre for conservatives. So the whole thing is so bizarre. And then this other issue is of the military, which now seems to be politically suspect because of the Pentagon has dove in to all these issues around social policy, and they could end up shooting themselves in the foot with conservatives.
Yeah, I enjoy owning the libs as much as anyone, but even that won't get me to watch a WNBA game. I can tell you that right now. But no, the military aspect in particular, I think, is interesting because, you know, I live in a very red area, very military area. We got Air Force base, we got a military base, we got a Navy base, more in the near vicinity. And people are really starting to waking up to the overt politicalization of the military. Now, this has always been the case, right? I mean, and if you look at the progressive era, I mean, a lot of it, you know, military regimentation, like this is always kind of baked in the pie there. But the, you know, ultimately, the truth matters less than people recognizing the truth, right? And so the fact that this is now becoming mainstream, and obviously Tucker Carlson's monologues on it, and just as important, the response from military leaders on Twitter acting like high school girls, like that does more to vividly show, you know, how much, you know, the attitude there.
Can you tell the audience a little bit, a few of those details?
We might have an audience that doesn't waste their time with cable news, but you know, Tucker Carlson was making a point about how, like, the priority of the modern military and is, you know, they care more about intersectionality and, you know, flight suits for pregnant women than they do about winning wars. And of course, given the record, I mean, America hasn't won a war in a while. Like, I mean, this was some of Donald Trump's best rhetoric. And I think it's important because, I mean, the military is a bureaucratic machine. And this is something that we've talked about in the past, is that, you know, the people that rewarded are not, you know, the skilled military men on the field. I mean, there's a bureaucratic skill set that, you know, is rewarded there, and often the worst rise to the top. And I think, you know, the more that they show that hand and reveal themselves to be the, I mean, General Mattis, for example, who spent, you know, decades building up one of the best PR firms out there in terms of making himself a modern American hero. I mean, he destroyed a lot of his credibility with a lot of huge fans with simply a lot of his politicized statements after the fact with Trump. And regardless of whose side on the issue you take, you don't have to defend Trump on the matter. I mean, the more people recognize that, the better off, you know, it's yet another institution in America that is losing its credibility with a large percentage of the population. I mean, Congress has been in the gutter for a long time. The executive branch has become completely politicized, right? I mean, there's very few people that respect the office, right, if it's not their guy in there. The Supreme Court is faltering, right, on both the left and the right. Military, right? I mean, this creates legitimacy issues that, you know, we haven't dealt with in a while.
Well, how bad was if you didn't see these tweets from the Pentagon and respond to Tucker? I mean, how would you describe these things?
It was this guy doing a video talking about how, you know, America's military is made all the better because we have pregnant women that serve. And it's like, and meanwhile, at the same time, I think that a lot of people, the amount of response, again, that I saw from veterans to it, you know, is absurd. And I mean, but this is the whole thing, though. It's going back to the Obama administration, right? When they start using the military tends to always be the starting spot for social experimentation. This is coupled with they're now giving free sex change operations if you want it, if you join the military. That's going to end up attracting certain people. You also have this very interesting dynamic going on where Democrats are actively questioning the loyalty of the vast majority of the military, because of how, because historically the military has been very Republican voting patterns, white male. Those are two bad words right now in the Democratic Party, right? You had Stephen Cohen, I think, the congressman from Tennessee, going into the inauguration saying, how can we trust the National Guard? Which is why, again, you had the optics of Biden being inaugurated by, surrounded by soldiers that they couldn't trust with guns. I'm like, this is, or with bullets. Like, this is like a Rothbardian masterpiece right here, right? I mean, this is the anatomy of the state in its most crude form presenting itself.
Same with cops, of course,
yes,
too, right?
Yeah, because people are reckoning it. The state is not your friend. And, like, this is a beautiful thing for conservatives to embrace. And, again, I think a lot of them always felt in their gut. I mean, it was really being at CPAC, where, like, you would talk to, like, genuine conservatives. And the way that they saw themselves was more libertarian than a lot of libertarians out there. Now, again, there's inconsistencies with the way that plays out in the political voting and all that. But, like, they still see themselves as kind of like the American revolutionary sort of mindset. And so, again, the more that the state explicitly projects how much they hate these people, the better off I think it's going to be in terms of the response from a large percentage of, you know, let's call it conservative America.
Yeah. And the response on Twitter was just so unhinged and toddler-ish.
Yeah, it was.
Right? They were posting pictures of themselves and just acting so, like, personally offended and hurt. They came off as very emotionally fragile.
Yes.
These Marines.
Yes.
I mean,
imagine what China thinks about that right now. It's like, the future is female, okay? Like, you know, like it's...
These Marines were so offended that anyone would criticize them on any level and just were astounded that they weren't above reproach, even when it came to just what was clearly a political maneuver, right? And that is, I think, real progress there, right? And to build on what you were saying, I used to have lunch, right, with even these people who build themselves as like these real free market people, and they would run some of these smaller state-level libertarian institutes and so on. And yeah, you were allowed to say, oh yeah, government should never run healthcare. But of course, governments were unimpeachable when it came to the CIA or the FBI or the military. All these institutions, totally non-corrupt, totally trustworthy, totally committed to doing the right thing all the time in every situation. And I think those feelings are just going out the door real quick.
Because again, the beauty of it is, how can you trust any agent of the federal government if you do not believe the president was legitimately elected in the first place? And again, this is an entire new age, and it's beautiful to watch.
And maybe that's it. Maybe the outcome of what's life like in the Biden age is just the further disintegration of public trust.
And you can't pick really a better icon of American decline than a president that appears to clearly to be losing his marbles one day at a time. I think there was a video that showed him like interviewing with the press, and like the way that his hands like interacted with the microphone underneath, like it kind of looked like a green screen. And apparently there's other angles that show it's fine. But like they had to address it. Like there's enough people willing to believe that the White House released a green screened message from Joe Biden that they had to respond to it. Again, this is progress. we're getting close. People are seeing that the Wizard of Oz sort of aspect of federal power here.
Now, I do not think that the moon landing was faked. However, you can imagine that if they tried to do that today, right? Oh, look, here's some film from the moon landing. Tons of people would be just primed to be suspicious, like right off the bat. And they would have to show all sorts of different angles and everything. And I made that point in a recent article, was there's reason for hope here, because when you look at all of just this out of control spending, all of these potential regulations that might come down, Americans actually are less primed to believe things now and than they were in, say, the 1930s in the old New Deal. When you look at the level that people just believed everything FDR told them and they were willing to go along with anything. And the most shameful of that was the whole gold confiscation thing. Here, no Congress involved. I just put out an executive order. And I believe the fine was $10,000 around there in 1933, I believe, is when this happened, which was a huge fine at the time. And Americans just turned, oh, here, take all my gold, all my savings. Here you go. Oh, you told me all my dollars will maintain the same value that they were going to have before. Of course, I believe you. The government said it. I would never question them. So these Americans of the 30s, 40s, 50s, they kind of believed everything.
And I think it's interesting because in a recent podcast, Michael Malice and Dave Smith were kind of making a opposite point here, where they're talking about how, imagine how much government has grown, because even in the Great Depression, they didn't think about sending out checks. And Dave Smith made the point, well, the monetary system didn't quite allow that the way it would now. But it's definitely true. The government is more powerful now in what it can do than ever before, the surveillance state and financial, et cetera. But again, the trust in that system is breaking in a way that it hasn't in a very long time. And again, I think that goes where I think Rothbard's analysis of, again, the importance of legitimacy as a, you know, in order to be able to really control the people. That's where things are getting really, there's a lot of reasons to be black-pilled out there. I think that's the biggest white pill there is.
So, I mean, where are we with this? We got a continuation of the trends in terms of fiscal and monetary policy. No real quantitative change there or change in real direction or policy. But maybe the direction that matters is just a continuation of the trend that already existed under Trump, is you had either one half of the country or the other who just despised whoever was in power and regarded it all as garbage. And I don't see any progress being made on repairing that. And I think when I quoted a Guardian article saying, oh, we're going back to the New Deal, and of course they meant that in a good way, we're going back to the New Deal, and Biden said we have to repair all this damage that's been done since Reagan, where people didn't trust their government and so on, but I'm going to sign all this new legislation, everybody's going to have trust in government again. I see zero evidence that they're going to make any headway on that whatsoever. If anything, it's going to go into a steep decline. And I was talking about this, though, with an economist last night, and he was saying, we still have a ways to go in terms of the U.S. really breaking up into smaller pieces or any sort of Soviet-style collapse. He says, because we're just now at the beginning of that process where people are really starting to question all of these institutions. He was saying that in the late Soviet Union, you could walk around and almost nobody believed in the Soviet state as like a functional institution. He said there were some military veterans who still loved the idea of Stalin and the Soviet state, but that everybody else just regarded it as a joke. And we were just kind of stumbling through life and we were just making the best of it. But all the people in power were idiots and the whole system was garbage. And he says, there's still too many Americans out there who think that this is all something worth dying for. And this is highly honorable, wonderful system. America's different. America's something special. However, once you get to the point where that goes into steep decline, then that's it. It's game over.
Well, and I think one of the interesting things that will play into that is the more, and this goes back to the point we were making earlier about the differences in state outcomes, right? The more that people think of themselves as Floridians rather than Americans, that's going to fuel into it. Because when you talk about the collapse of the Soviet Union, I mean, a lot of it had to do with, national liberation movements with them. They were still those common ties with people rather than just like a revolutionary overthrow of the Soviet Union, as a bloc. I mean, there's a lot of those historical ties that really kind of helped, undo some of the threads there. And I think that the more that Americans, again, with the increased importance of state governments, the increased recognition of people like Ron DeSantis or on the left, right? I mean, it's interesting as you're seeing the falling of Cuomo and Newsom, but like the more people, again, the hero cult that Andrew Cuomo had even kind of played a role in that back in the day before it aged poorly. That I think all kind of, we're creating rivals to that loyalty that Uncle Sam has. And again, I know I have a much more loyalty to the Florida Flamingo than I do Uncle Sam these days.
Well, we're going to have to call it a day there for this edition of Radio Rothbard. We'll be back in a week or so with more. So until then, have a wonderful week.